Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm in New York with Aaron Lammer. Evan Ratliff is still in Austin, Texas.
But we've got a very special episode for you today. This is our live South by Southwest extravaganza. We threw a little party with ASME, Texas Monthly, Longform and the Atavist at Schultz's Beer Hall. Quick disclaimer, this was a lot of fun and resulted in less than optimal sound.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Schultz is a great place to get drunk, maybe not a great place to record a podcast.
Yes, but we had a great lineup of guests, all of whom have at some point written for Texas Monthly. Pam Koloff with Max. Evan talked to
Mimi Schwartz.
And in part two of this episode, which you will have to hit forward to get to the next episode of, it was me with Lawrence Wright. Who are our sponsors this week?
We've got PillPack. You know about PillPack?
I've wanted to just, I'm going to pick a medication and start getting it just so I can get it through PillPack.
Here's what PillPack does. They replace your pharmacy. They are a pharmacy themselves. They send all of your pills, all your vitamins in easy-to-open packets, pre-sorted, right to your doorstep. Go to pillpack.com/longform and you get the first month free.
If you are trying to send out something that's more ethereal and ambiguous than pills, maybe you should do so in the textual form by starting an email newsletter with Tiny Letter. It's a simple, powerful way to stay in touch with people who care about what you've got to say.
I only want to do things in textual form now.
Yeah, it's text.
All right, here's me and Pam. Hi.
Hi, Max.
We've actually done this before. This is the first time that I have interviewed someone for the podcast a second time when it wasn't some specific breaking story. And so I went back and listened to the last one because I wanted to make sure, like, we, you know, covered new ground.
It was pretty great.
You know, it's funny that you say that because that was not the experience that I mean, you were great, but listening to it, I did not feel that way about my own half of the conversation. And it was early on. I tried not listen to some of the early podcasts because the sound isn't great, and like this, it bums me out. And but I was still kind of figuring out how to do interviews then. Not that I've got it all figured out now, but I was worse off. And that one started, and I remember we were on Skype, and I was sitting in my living room on headphones. And we finally got it to work and all the sound and stuff. And then I was just like, hey, how's your Monday? Which is really a terrible, terrible opening question. And I'll try and do better. I'll try and do better is my point of that story.
I'm still figuring out how to interview people. I think it's an ongoing process.
Really?
So it's
do you think you're getting better at it?
Yes, because I sort of stopped interviewing them. I just talked to them. Instead of having, I don't look at my list of questions very often.
Do you do a list of questions and then just not look at it?
I do a list of questions and I put them away. And I get them out toward the end of the interview to make sure I haven't missed anything really crucial. But I try to make it conversational and, you know, like a normal normal way of talking to someone.
How did that evolve? Like when you were starting out, did you have like a long list and you'd sit down and just rattle them off?
I'd have this incredibly, you know, just detailed list of questions that went on for pages and pages, and I'd be looking down at the questions and not listening and not focusing and being, you know, really preoccupied with, well, I've got to ask that thing that's on the bottom of the page and I can't forget. And now I know that I can circle back to someone if I need to, and that sadly, if someone agrees to talk to me, they're in for it for the long haul, and we're going to be talking many, many times, and it's not a one-shot sort of deal.
Do you make that clear up front? Like, do you let people know, like, here's the thing, if you want to be part of this story, I'm going to be, like, pretty annoying for a while.
I tell them enough to give them a general sense of things, but not so much that they actually understand how horrible it's going to be. Because, I mean, these are months and months and months of talking every day and or emailing every day and, you know, dealing with fact checkers later in the process and photographers, and it just goes on and on. So, and I'm a pest. Like, that's, you know, I know the story.
But you're a casual pest. You don't have notes or anything.
I casually pester people. But to me, I feel like I'm ready to write when someone is about to kick me out of their house. Like, that's when I'm getting close. Yeah.
Do you, like, I've been thinking about this in terms of these interviews too. Like, do you start light? Like, what? Mm-hmm. How do you get into? Because you're talking with people about the most emotional experiences of their lives, often, and things that where the wounds are still pretty open.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do you get to that point? Do you kind of slow roll that, or do you just, you know, walk in and dive into it?
No, I definitely slow roll it, and make sure that they're comfortable and may save some difficult things for later down the road. But I make sure they know at the outset what I'm going to be asking of them and also what I'm looking for from them. Not with everybody, but with certain sources. I think it helps to give them some parameters of the story that you are hoping to tell and the role that they play in that and why it is that you're there and why it is that you need them to talk to you.
How do you do that? And do people, I guess I'm like, you're also talking to people often who haven't talked to people in the press.
Mm-hmm.
How forward are you in that conversation? How important is it to you that people understand it all? And how important is it to you when you're done that they've understood what's happened before it goes to press?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, there are definitely things in the course of any story that people tell me, and they're fantastic personal details that I don't always choose to put in the story, because I think if people get very comfortable with you, sometimes they forget that you are a reporter, you're not their friend. And you may become their friend later, but when you're in the process of writing about them, it's a different relationship. If there's something sensitive like that, I may go over it with them and say, you know, is this something that you're comfortable, you know, right, having all your friends read about? And even when you go over it with someone, I think they still may not grasp it until, you know, I always think about someone standing in the grocery store and seeing, you know, Texas Monthly there and opening it up and there's their picture and their words and what is that experience going to be like for them? And I try to take that into account. Because when I haven't, it's been bad.
Yeah, do you have some ugly stories in that realm?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you forget the power that you have as a writer, and that this is, especially now that things are disseminated so widely, that what you write is something that maybe, it may not be, maybe something that nobody reads, but it may be something that their coworkers read, their children's friends read. And that's something I definitely think about when I'm writing.
It's interesting to hear you say that you can sort of forget your power as a writer, because for the last several years you've been doing these hugely powerful stories that are in a way designed to have an impact beyond the story itself. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm interested in how you decided to start doing those kinds of stories. And they're so life and death. They are literally life and death.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also interested in how you start doing other kinds of stories ever again. Like, how does anything pale in comparison to exonerating someone who's got life without parole or whatever it may be?
Sure. Well, I really do want to branch out, but these stories keep pulling me back in, as they say. I think that these stories are so compelling, they're so inherently dramatic, that in a way they're easier than other pieces. You know, you have inherent drama and tension and a story arc and characters built into them in a crime story, and particularly a wrongful conviction story. And so I'm trying to, this year, while still focusing on criminal justice, take things in a little bit of a different direction. So I'm not doing the same thing over and over again.
Can you tell us anything about what you're doing?
Well, I just finished writing a story that was a nice story about a prosecutor, which I've never done before. And I was hoping that would help me, frankly, a little bit, because now when I call prosecutors, they don't want to talk to me. So I thought I could sort of proffer this.
They know they're ready for like the Koloff treatment.
I don't know what it is that they're afraid of, but it's been a problem. So hopefully this story will help in some way.
So this is really just to appease the DA.
Exactly.
It's like a guy, political cover.
But no, the story was, it's in our current issue, and it's about a district attorney who, 17 years after the fact, is looking back on a case in which he sent a 17-year-old to prison for life, and he's no longer certain that that's the correct punishment for this kid who's now a man. And he decides to go and visit with him and sort of see who he turned into after all these years in prison. And showing a prosecutor in that sort of nuanced and complex light was really interesting to me.
Couple of things I want to talk to you about that story. So part of it is that you had also written a story 12 years ago,
mm-hmm,
about the case,
right,
that was sort of a more traditional sort of crime story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really struck that you went back 12 years later and sort of did this update. I mean, mm-hmm. it was like a follow-up, and you've actually been doing a lot of that, like the mm-hmm. Morton story, The Innocent Man, the one you won the National Magazine Award for, you've continued to cover pretty heavily. And I guess, you know, you only do a couple stories a year. Mm-hmm. So why, instead of going into something new, how do you think about those stories? Do the stories ever end for you?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things about these criminal justice stories is because of appeals and various things going on, they live on and on and on. And there's so many interesting twists and turns that keep happening, and I can't not write about them. Right. So I try to move on, but I can't. But with this particular case, I wrote a real straight sort of noir-y crime story 12 years ago, and then had kept in touch with the prosecutor and several people in the story and realized there was another story to write. And it actually, I thought it would be an easier story, which I don't know if this is true for y'all, but that's always a curse for me. If I'm like, oh, this is going to be an easy one. Those are the ones that are the worst. But I thought it would just be a follow-up story. Right. And just my writing
bang
style...
Bang it out and go on vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My writing style and so many, and my interests and so many other things had changed in those 12 years that putting myself back in the same case, it was actually really difficult. And trying to figure out how to recap a case I knew that well without telling it again
was it difficult just from a journalistic perspective, or was there something difficult about you personally going back into that story?
I think if you look at any work that you've done a dozen years ago, you may be, you know, appalled or shocked or whatever the word is. But it was really interesting to go back and look at that piece. And I'm proud of the first piece, but you know, as I read it, I'm editing it. I'm like, oh, that's such an over-the-top description. Oh, that's just... And I think, I don't know if this is everyone's experience, but in mine, as I do this longer, I use spare language, and I'm not trying as hard. I think when I was starting off doing this, I was trying so hard.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if we talked about this before, but I wrote my undergraduate thesis on Tom Wolfe. And that was, you know, of course, he's amazing, but that's what I used to think was the best you could do nonfiction-wise.
We've had a couple people who've come on and gone through that experience where, like, they look back at the early stuff they've written, and it's oftentimes, like, really voicey.
Very voicey, yes.
Do you think that's just a matter of, like, your taste evolving, or do you think that
sure.
the work you're doing now is, like, empirically just better?
No, I don't think it's better. I think it's different. But just to give you an example, in the previous story, you know, everyone I interviewed, I quoted. I wanted to make sure that you knew that I had done my homework. And now I am a more confident writer. And so the story, though I interviewed many, many people in the story, really the only people who are quoted at any length are the inmate and the district attorney. There are very few quotes other than that. And so I kept the focus really tight. And so even though I interviewed the victim's mother, I interviewed the defendant's defense attorney, you don't know that. And you don't need to know that because I give you that information.
Right.
So...
And those folks had all changed, and so, I mean, it's like the whole
right.
thing has evolved. I want to keep just on that, like, following up thing for a second, because I'm pretty interested in that. When you say, like, I kept in touch with them, you've done, I don't know, hundreds of stories. Are you keeping in touch with everyone? What does, like, keeping in touch mean? Are you just, like sitting there, like half your day is, like, emailing sources? And how does it work?
It's a surprising amount of my day. Email is, yes, taking over my life. No, I do keep in touch with people, and they keep in touch with me, and... Not everybody. There are plenty of stories I finish and people never want to have anything to do with me again. I try to not make that happen, but it's inevitable in some cases. But no, I mean, when you spend 4 or 5 months getting to know somebody, often getting to know their family, having dinner with them, you know, and in the course of that, I will tell them things about my life. It's not always an extremely formal relationship. It seems weird to then just be like, thanks, see you later.
Right.
You know, especially with the nature of some of these stories. You know, for example, Anthony Graves, who was released from prison 3.5 years ago, he is still very much on a journey of learning how to live a normal life again. And
right.
so keeping in touch with him is important.
I'm sure. I mean, it sounds amazing to me and also kind of draining. Well, I guess you're saying you're starting to work on different kinds of stuff. It feels mm-hmm. like... Do you think that there's like a cap on how many of those stories that you can do? And I assume that because they have been so successful, both for you journalistically, but also in terms of the effect they had, that you're getting pleas all the time for people
sure.
who want you to tell their story.
There is a lot of that, though many of them are not actually magazine narratives, which is a painful realization to make because some of them are really interesting cases. But no, they are very seductive because people are interested in them and they are read widely. But I've come to think more and more that the innocence cases, in a way, are the easy ones. Like the case I just wrote about with the DA, the defendant is guilty. There's no question of his guilt. And to me, that was a more interesting narrative. You know, he did this terrible thing when he was 17 years old, and the questions that that engenders, should he be in prison for the rest of his life or not, were to me less cut and dry and therefore more interesting than should this innocent person be sitting in prison. Do you know what I mean?
Right. It's like a little murkier.
Right.
And the DA, I mean, you're you know, saying that like you wrote it in part to like make DAs feel better about talking to you, but that guy had like fallen on some hard times. It wasn't
right.
It wasn't like he just one day woke up and was thinking right. about that guy. He had gone through some shit.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I was interested in that. This DA had been this very well-known, very successful DA in North Texas, and he had a drinking problem that he successfully hid for a long time, and then it caught up with him, and sort of his whole life fell apart. And that humbling experience allowed him to have insight into this particular defendant in a way that he had not had before. And that connection, I thought, was narratively really interesting.
Was he game for that story? Was he game for his whole story to be told?
Yes and no. It was a really interesting process because I knew, obviously, that the district attorney's name is Tim Cole. I knew that Tim's story would be a big part of the piece and that he would be, that readers would connect with him perhaps better than the person who committed this murder. And I knew that at some point I would have to mention his drunk driving arrest and that he had had to resign and the shame associated with that. But as often happens when I started writing, and then especially when we started editing, it became evident that we really had to really, really dig into that part of the story. And so I had been completely upfront with him about this is stuff we need to go into, and yet in the end we went into it much, much more than he was ever anticipating. And that was something that we had to negotiate through the whole process.
How did the family respond to the story being brought up again? Did you go back and talk to them?
I did. That I felt was a separate story. And so for better or for worse, I didn't delve into that. The dad who I had talked to at great length for the first story would not talk to me. And he basically just, as you can imagine, if you lose a daughter at 16, is still going through a very difficult time. Her mother is very, very ill. So we had conversations, but they weren't incredibly involved conversations. And I was able to get her perspective in to the story still. So
how do you do that? How do you talk to the family of a 16-year-old who was murdered about a story you're doing about how one of the boys who was arrested for her murder is serving 40 years or whatever it is, mm-hmm. maybe his sentence shouldn't be that. Like, how do you talk to generally the families of victims when either the innocence is in question or, you know, the sense of justice that they may have gotten is in question? How do you have that conversation?
I was in an easier position because I had a relationship with them from back then, but it was the same issue when I wrote the original story, which was I think that they wanted to make sure that people knew what had happened. They wanted people to know who their daughter was. I always, especially in a story, even if it may be read as more sympathetic to a defendant, and I hope that the stories don't read that way, I always want to make sure that the victim is as human and remembered as possible in those stories, and that also the horribleness...
Does that mean telling like a full, painting like a full picture of them, both the...
As much as you can, I think, and also not shying away from the bad details of the case. And you can see, like, the term advocacy journalism comes up a lot, and I really don't like that term, because to me, advocacy journalism at its worst skims over some of the worst facts of a particular crime. And to me, including those facts makes you credible and makes the story more complex and interesting and reliable.
I won't use the term advocacy journalism, but when you're looking at those stories, you've got all these cases coming to you. You're looking for a story that's a good story, it sounds like, first and foremost. How important is the impact that a story might have mm-hmm. on someone's life with the case?
I have never been good at predicting that. There have been stories that I've worked on where I thought, oh boy, when this comes out, you know, this is just going to be so big. And we get maybe two letters from readers, and then the month is over, and I get really depressed. So that's happened a number of times. And then other times, I mean, I never would have imagined in the Anthony Graves case that everything that happened would happen. I just never in a million. So I'm a terrible predictor of what resonates with people and what is going to happen. I just know that, to me, like the stories that where I'm driving my husband and my friends crazy because I'm talking about them all the time and I'm preoccupied with them, those are the stories I have to write.
We've had a couple people who've come on and said, basically, I'm writing the stories that are about myself. Do you think that's a part of how you're picking these things? Or like, is there a personal, I mean, not like you're a murderer, but like, do you have a personal connection to the people you end up writing about? Is there something that you see in them? I have a theory. This is like such a leading question, but I have a theory, which is there's like kids come up a lot, and mm-hmm. and you are a mom, and you write often about kids, both kids who have died and kids who commit crimes. And mm-hmm. I wonder how much of that plays into how you pick those stories.
That is the best question anyone has ever asked me. And I'm stumped, but let me try. First of all, it has never occurred to me that the stories had anything to do with me, per se. But that said, sort of the turning point in my life was the very sudden death of my father when I was 20. And this sense of loss and the sense that, you know, normal life can turn on a dime and not be normal anymore. And that really impacted me. And so that sense of loss and that sense of normal life turning on a dime is something that, in a very different way, I've experienced, and I feel like I carry that with me definitely into some of the more difficult stories. So it's not that I'm writing that story, but maybe if you're going to get all Freudian, maybe there's something there. So.
Okay, well, something there seems like we're getting close.
That was a very thought-provoking question that I'm going to keep thinking about for a few weeks. If I'm drawn to murderers because there's something, you know, in my background that.
Yeah, well, maybe there's some like latent murderous tendencies, but we'll get to that the third time we talk.
Thank you so much, Max. Thank you.
Hey, it's Max, back in New York, on the regular microphone. We got Evan and Mimi Swartz coming up live from Austin, but I'm going to take a second and tell you about our sponsor real quick. It's PillPack. This is actually a totally great idea. If you or someone you know is taking lots of medication, lots of vitamins, sitting there on Sunday nights at the kitchen table with all their bottles and their pill box open, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, pulling out all of their pills and putting it in the box, hoping they don't screw it up, PillPack is going to change their lives. It is a pharmacy. It's a full-on pharmacy, except you don't need to go to them. They come to you. PillPack delivers everything you need pre-sorted in these easy-to-open packets. Prescriptions, vitamins, all sorted by date and time and delivered right to your doorstep. It comes in like a big roll, so if you're going away for a couple of days, you just pull off all the packets you need, rip them off, put them in your bag. It really couldn't be easier. Go check it out, pillpack.com/longform. That's pillpack.com/longform. You'll get the first month free. They've got great customer service. It's really easy. Check it out. It's also a way to support the show. That's another perk of using them. So go do that. And in the meantime, here we go. Mimi Swartz, Evan Ratliff, live from Austin.
You probably all know Mimi, or if you don't know Mimi, don't know her writing, it means you either never read Texas Monthly or you don't read very much in general. So I sat down, as we do oftentimes for these, and we try to go back and read someone's archive to really sort of understand the breadth of everything that they've worked on. And I got about a week into it and realized it was essentially impossible, given the amount of time that I had to read everything that she's written over the years. So I want to sort of cover a little bit of that breadth, but I wanted to start by talking about you've won two National Magazine Awards for public interest. You've been a finalist for another National Magazine Award. You've won a pile of a bunch of other awards. And for those particular awards, they were around stories that were very large. They were very large in scope. And I'm interested in, particularly, maybe we could talk about the one from 2 years ago, which is called Mothers, Sisters, Daughters, Wives, about basically the history of women's health in Texas. And I'm curious, first, sort of, when you approach a story like that, something that large, how do you start? Where how do you grapple with an issue? Did you just sit down and say, I'm going to attack this issue as large as I can? Or how do you sort of get into a story like that?
Stupidity is what I would say, is that when people have said to me, oh, you do these big, complicated stories, and I'm like, okay, I guess I do, but I don't start out that, like Pam said, that started out seeming to me a fairly straightforward story, and this is how I tend to start. And then what happens is I really love reporting, so I think, well, I'll keep going and see what else I find out. And then it becomes this horrible morass that's out of control, and I need someone like my editor, Jake, to pull me out of it. But
so when you're in the middle of it, how do you have any sense of where, of directionally, that you're getting the place that you want to go when you're in the middle of the reporting?
I tend to not know when I'm in the middle. There's a deadline. That really helps, because you know you got to turn something in. Or my former editor, Greg Curtis, used to talk about white space in the magazine. And if there's anything I've ever been really terrified of, it's white space in the magazine, because that means unemployment follows. So you know, I think there is a point where you know you've got X amount of time and you've got to make your story fit into those parameters. So there is a point. I mean, I tend to stop reporting when I'm hearing the same stories over and over again, and I know, okay, you've got to sit down and start writing. So.
And do you, in terms of your sort of personal approach, like for instance to that story, do you feel like you are driven in the reporting writing at all by outrage, by personal outrage over these issues? I mean, when you win a sort of public service award, the implication is that, you know, you were going after one of these issues to try and drive change because there was something wrong here. But is that what is pushing you motivationally, or is it just a sort of curiosity?
It is curiosity, although I will say in that particular story, I think, again, I don't know, where is Jake? I think it's very important to have an editor who doesn't think exactly the way you do, so that someone can say, well, let's get people to read this story. You know, you don't want to write a piece that's just preaching to the choir. I do want to make people think when I write. So it's very good to have someone else say, well, maybe there's another way to say this, or is this really what you mean? And let's think about tempering this. I mean, no one at Texas Monthly has ever said to me, no, you can't do it this way. But I like having people pushing back and just questioning what I'm doing, because I think that story was helped enormously by having someone else say, just ask me questions about how far I really want to go.
And when you're writing stories like that, I mean, you've written stories in a similar vein about, you know, tort reform in Texas and the influence that it has on people. So there's sort of this high-level idea, and then there's the people, individual people who are affected by it. And when you get to the end, when you get to the writing portion of it, what do you have in mind in terms of what kind of impact you want it to have?
Yeah, it's more like what you said. I get sort of excited about, oh my God, here's this great story no one's ever told. So how can I write it so that the maximum number of people want to read it? In other words, I think we used to talk about, you know, here's the homework part of the story. Mm-hmm. And I try to make the homework as interesting and compelling as possible by finding people who've sort of lived the homework and trying to explain it that way.
You're being very humble and giving a lot of credit to your editors, but I think in reading those stories that to write them takes a certain amount of like authorial voice. Like you have to have the personal belief that you can sort of speak definitively on this topic. I mean, the Mothers, Sisters, Daughters, Wives, it almost reads like a sort of, for history's purposes, we're going to lay out what happened here, what happened with reproductive policy, and for instance, in Texas. And so I kind of want to get out how you found that authoritarian voice, starting with just, you started at Texas Monthly a long, long time ago. How did you first get into, I'm curious how you first got into journalism and how you then made the jump to Texas Monthly?
Well, I'm trying to remember. I think when I was young, I stumbled upon Joan Didion and Nora Ephron. And I sort of thought, oh, women can do this. Look at these stories. They're fantastic. This is what I want to do. And I didn't even know that was what I wanted to do. And I started out doing beauty stories and, you know, sort of social status stories. And it's like Pam says, I think at a certain point, you just realize, oh, I can write the same way and think the same way about bigger issues. And it's very addictive thinking that you could write something that might change policy in Texas. That has not happened with reproductive policy yet, but you at least want to try. I mean, this is the best place for writers ever. You never run out of material. So it's like my husband says about Houston, you cannot walk out your front door without falling over a great story. So it's really a blessing to be living here, and you find your authorial voice because there are people doing so many nutty things, and somebody should be pointing out, you know, I don't think I'm the only one, but many people should be pointing out these are very nutty things, and they're not good for the state, so.
You also had a period after you had been on staff at Texas Monthly for a while where you went and worked for The New Yorker on staff, and you went and worked at Talk Magazine, which maybe some people in here might not even know. And what made you decide to make that change, and how was it different going to write for those magazines than what you had experienced, you know, here in Texas?
Well, the main thing, and again, I don't know, Larry might be able to speak to this more, but I think one of the things I found out is, you know, I grew up here. This is my home. And I think I have more to say to people here. I am more invested in the world of Texas. And so I think that's why I loved working at The New Yorker. I think I had a very small child at the time, and I think it wasn't a very good fit. Talk wasn't a good fit because I wanted to do these bigger, longer stories. I think that we all find a place where we can speak to the people we need to talk to. And I'm certainly not saying I wouldn't want to write for The New Yorker again. I wouldn't want to write for The New York Times again. But I think because I grew up here, I can bring an understanding to it that I can convey. And again, the material's just, you know, incomparable. So,
how do you experience your relationship with readers in Texas? I mean, you've written not only you've written all sorts of stories, but also some very intimate stories. I'm thinking of a story which is a little bit shorter that was about your grandmother's engagement ring. And there was so much wrapped up in this story about your family, about, you know, marriage, and about your son. And I'm curious, do you feel like there are Texas readers who sort of know you because you've been here? And is that who you're speaking to? Or are you speaking to the reader who has never read your stuff before?
I think probably both is what I try to do. I think, and again, I don't know whether my coworkers or co-writers feel this way, but I think Texas has changed so much. When I was a kid, it was still a rural state, and now it's a very urban state. But I think I had also hoped it might become a more progressive state, and now it's almost like we're going backwards. I had a friend who was in political life calling it a failed state the other day. And, you know, again, that's material for me, but I do sometimes wonder who I'm talking to. I read the letters that we get at Texas Monthly and think, you know, sometimes they get really mad and you have to have an answer for them. But I think, you know, I just try to put myself on the page and hope that there will be a response, whether, and I understand when people get mad, that's fine too. I don't, you know, I think either way, as long as I'm making them think, then that's okay, whether it's essay or a reported story. So,
do you ever despair around any of these issues, to sort of look at things that you've really tackled and then find that they haven't changed?
I've lived here a long time. I I don't despair. I think I am still actually kind of naive about things and hope that we will be able to change things eventually. And you know, maybe I finished a piece for Vogue about military rape that ran this month, and the Kristen Gillibrand's idea went down in flames. It didn't work. And, you know, I have to say I had a bad morning. I thought, well, of course this is going to pass. You know, this is the sensible thing. And then, you know, like everybody else, you think, well, no, we'll just start again and keep going.
I also wanted to ask you about it's a slightly different kind of story, but I feel like I'd be remiss in asking about it because I loved it so much, which is the story about the UT track coach, which is a different flavor of story because it's more of a profile. But first, people should go read it because I'm about to spoil a little bit of the ending to it. But I'm curious about your experience of reporting that because it seemed like I had no awareness of her situation and losing her job before, but it seemed like there was an existing sort of narrative around what had happened. And did you know that that narrative might not hold up when you went in? And how did you find that out?
Well, this is like the Pam Koloff situation where I thought, this is a pretty straightforward, easy story to do. And because we had talked about this in our editorial meetings, and this was a terrible thing that this had happened to this wonderful woman who had done so much for UT. And I started reporting it. And then I went to lunch with someone, you know, after being on jury duty. And he said to me, well, you ought to talk to this friend of mine because he tells a different story. And I said, okay, who is it? I'll talk to him. And this is one of the lessons I've learned as a reporter is every time somebody tells you to go talk to somebody, you damn well better talk to them. Because if I had gone on and ignored him at my peril, I mean, the story could have blown up in my face. I called this guy. His daughter had run for UT. He was white and prosperous. And he told me some stories about abuse. And I thought, okay, you know, I'll keep it in mind. But I kept reporting, and then when I started trying to track down former runners, they just weren't available. You know, either Bev would say, well, they don't want to get crosswise with UT, and I had one person in the athletic department who was sort of a deep throat, who had come from this same guy in Alabama, and he said, look, just... He didn't want to tell me very much, but he said, just call every woman on the roster from this period to this period. And I think I called, you know, called, emailed, charged an enormous amount of searches to the magazine till I found somebody who finally just started talking. I mean, and I had seen her name in a USA Today comments line where she had said, this is not the Bev I know or knew. And it was a story, again, about how terrible it was and that Bev was fired. And I went to Utah to interview. Again, I want to thank my editor because I went all over the place trying to track down these women. And she didn't want to talk to me in person, so I went to Utah and sat in the blazing sun while she was coaching. And she just laid out really how this woman had almost ruined her life. And from her, I found very slowly other girls. And then because they were friends, then they would tell their other friends it was okay to talk to me. But it was a fantastic experience. I have to say, I really love doing that story. So.
When you had to actually go back to Bev, who's the former track coach, and sort of, I assume, lay out some of this stuff for her, I mean, did you ever have a moment where you thought you didn't want to do the story that went that way, that you actually... You thought, well, maybe I just won't do this story if it goes in this direction, or these are sort of two questions. And then the other question is, what was your approach to sort of go back to this person and say, I'm not finding the same narrative that you are projecting necessarily?
Well, I was lucky in that a lot of the things she told me were true. She's very smart, and her take on UT, I think, was correct about how frightened they were of change and things like that. So I could go that far with her. And then I would say to her, look, you know, I've talked to these former teammates and they were not happy with you. And she would say, you know, it was a reasonable answer. Well, you know, there are always going to be a few on a team that don't work out. But, and I kept that in mind, but it was the fact that I kept calling runners and it didn't matter whether they had run for her when she first got to UT. I think at the end of the 90s, or whether they were running for her now, they told the same story. And that's why I went with the young women, because the damage, I felt bad because she has such strength and such intelligence. She's brilliant. But what she did to those young women was inexcusable. I mean, if that had been my child, and I thought also there was a larger issue. We'd seen a lot of coaching scandals come from the male side, and I thought, well, this is, you know, it happens to women too, so it needs to be written about.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautifully written story, and it's also, it's very complex. There's these, you know, it's not like there's a hero and a villain. There's sort of multiple layers to it, and it's really...
The editor credit again, so...
I think we're getting close to being up, but I wanted to touch on, I mean, you wrote this book about Enron, and I was looking back, and it's a little more than 10 years since that book came out. And in the vein of Max asking Pam, sort of, you know, do you keep up with these people? I'm curious how you look at the Enron story now, if you think about it, if you, you know, check in on you know, even you know, you're writing with a whistleblower, basically. If you talk to her, and where that sort of is in your life now.
Well, I still think it's a great, great story. I think this was the, you know, they were in a lot of ways the canary in the coal mine for every financial disaster that followed. I do still keep up with Sharon Watkins, and I keep up with Amanda Martin, who was sort of the femme fatale of Enron. But I keep thinking somebody should do that as a movie. It's full of great characters, and it just will never, you know, I don't feel like I did it justice. I almost feel like I could go back now. You know, a friend of mine said, no, you should spend 10 years on this book about Enron. I thought, no way. But it could have worked. I just think it did predict what was coming in a way that still hasn't been taken fully into account.
Have you, are you given thought to writing another book at all?
I am doing another book now about heart disease because I can't get out of Houston, and that's where sort of the whole world of heart disease is based. So.
Oh, wow. So do you, and is there any personal element to it, or is it all reporting?
It's just, I have to say, I am totally attached to Houston, and it's a sneaky way to do a history of Houston. And that's why. And the again, like Enron, they're fantastic characters, and there's a lot of drama. So it should be fun.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Hey, this is Max. That's it for part one. Moving on to part two. Aaron Lammer, Larry Wright. It's queued up wherever you're listening to this. It's just the next one. Go listen to it. It's great.